It's time for She Says Art and He Says Science, your weekly hour of edutainment as you learn about the creative interaction between artists and scientists with your host, Jill Dittmeyer, a journalist and arts enthusiast, and Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit. The call-in phone number is 317-788-3314. Now it's time for She Says Art and He Says Science.
Hello, I'm Jill Dittmeyer, curious journalist and arts enthusiast.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and community can create unique interactions and conversations.
And we are doing that today, and we are doing it via Zoom because it's 2020 and we're still not able to get back into the radio studios. So we're doing an audio and video Zoom call with our guests so we can still see their faces and you can still enjoy their voices. And today we're talking about reopening those hands-on museums during a pandemic and the changes that need to be made, everything from sanitation to face coverings. Mark, introduce our guests and we'll get this conversation started.
Yeah, we're excited to have Kathy Faree, the president and CEO of the Indiana State Museum with us. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Mark. Hi.
And we have Dr. Charles Venable, the Melvin and Bryn Simon director and CEO of the Indianapolis Museum of Art, Newfields, a place for nature and art. Hi, Charles.
Hi, Mark and Jill. It's great to be on your program.
Great to have you guys with us. And as we should probably just start at the beginning, because although nobody really remembers when the beginning was, but when did the both of you first learn that museums had to shut down? And what was the first kind of thought that went through your mind at that point? Kathy, we'll start with you.
Okay. I think my thought was, you've got to be kidding me. You know, it was a time of year. We were getting ready for spring break. We were really excited about inviting, you know, the May school kids in, and, you know, it's, you know, St. Patrick's Day that will never be fun again. Yeah. Because it sort of all rolled up and then it was, you know, you're going to have to close on March 17th, and just having those conversations and really trying to determine what closing meant. You know, we have 12 locations across the state. So do we close everybody at once? You know, what do we do? And so there were, you know, a group of us around the table for about a week before we closed saying, okay, but what does that mean? Like, what happens when we close? What do you do? Who needs to do what? And how do we move forward from here?
Charles, the same with you guys.
Oh my God. And we also closed on the 17th, as did so many institutions in Indianapolis. Ironically, or maybe just serendipitously, we are circulating an old master painting show with our Rembrandts and things like that in China. I was there on January 10th for a big opening, and we've been working on this show for like 3 years. And the reason I bring that up is because we had made some pretty good friends with Chinese curators and directors. And of course, they closed before we did. They closed, our show closed 2 weeks after it opened. And so we were starting to get this stream of email updates from our Chinese colleagues. And so all of a sudden I was like going, oh my gosh, this could happen in the United States. Because then we were just starting to see, you know, fairly soon you started to see cases pop up and New York was getting worse. And so by the time, if you fast forwarded to March, I think the 17th was a Tuesday, if I remember correctly. And a lot of museums like us, we're closed on Mondays. And I remember just an endless amount of conversation on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, through that whole weekend with our staff saying, how do we shut down a giant 600,000 square foot museum, a garden, a park? Do you need to shut the park? Our first plan was to keep the park and the garden open and close the building. And then that became impossible because of all the regulations and restrictions. And we had to figure out protocols, how to do all that to keep our audience safe. And the easiest thing was to close.
Yeah, you know, that for both of you, that's interesting to me because I worked a while ago for a couple of really large institutions, and we never had plans for something like this. We never did any planning for this long term, that where you would also restart. You know, we might have thought maybe we would have a fire or something that would be bad and serious, and we could plan for that. This is unprecedented because you were not knowing when you shut down when you would open. I mean, you didn't have any clues.
Yeah. And we still
are painfully aware of that, Mark.
I know.
Yeah.
At that point, do you reach out then to other organizations, or do you really just kind of focus in to see what you have and what you can do?
Oh, I would say that the number of people who immediately learn how to do Zoom calls and Teams calls and, you know, all these kind of things, which we sell, frankly, I'd seldom done too much of this. Why would you kind of bother? And all of a sudden, you know, sure, Kathy and I know each other, but all of a sudden the Arts Council's coordinating 100 arts leaders every single Friday. We're still doing it every Friday. And then we would have our own little cohort group of the Idlejord, Kathy, myself, a few other people all talking about, well, how the heck are we, you know, you can lock the door, but then what do you do? There's just endless amounts of detail that you kind of have to learn from scratch. And frankly, you know, with no disrespect too much, our governments have not been overly helpful. You know, there were no federal mandates. There were nothing, as opposed to every state's kind of fending for itself. And I actually think Governor Holcomb was the head of the pack in many ways, helping us, you know, consistently following a plan that he laid out, and seeing him recently say, we're going to slow down and we're going to mandate masks. That's leadership that a lot of other parts of the country didn't have.
And that was really important in making decisions, because, you know, we were, and as a state entity, very concerned about what the state was looking at, and as well as all of our other constituents. But, you know, we were watching Governor Holcomb on the news every day, you know, and I just said to the staff, if you want to know, watch his news conference, and then I'll, you know, we'll pull out of it what you need to know. And we had weekly meetings, Zoom meetings for all staff, so that I could have pulled out, the leadership team could pull out from those news conferences what we needed to know. And I think that was really helpful, that consistent communication is what I think made a big difference. And I know it made a big difference to our staff, because you at least had an idea of what was happening across the state, as well as how it might affect you personally.
Right. And New Hills is in a different place, because we're technically a private institution that serves the public. But since we're private, we could totally, I mean, we could say you have to wear a mask, even if the governor didn't say that. That all said, it sets up this dialectic of opposition were we not all aligned. So we were really thrilled that both the mayor of Marin County and the governor have, you know, what I would say is just done the right thing and been extra cautious, unlike my hometown of Houston, you know, which I'm talking to my family all the time. And the stories are just crazy, just nuts of what people are going out and doing.
Yeah, I tell my friends in the East Coast that we were lucky to be in Indiana during this with the leadership that we have had. It's been a pretty amazing, because I did feel informed, and I think it's because of what the governor was doing, but it's also goes back to what you guys were doing, which is talking to your staff, your patrons, and people regularly. You didn't just go away and, you know, not know what to do, which would be, I think, a normal reaction would be, oh my gosh, I'm overwhelmed. What do I do? It's a lot for a director.
Yeah, the Arts Council really, I have to say, Julie did an incredible job of,
absolutely.
I mean, immediately took over, and it was just a grounding for all of us, so that we would have a sense of what else, who was doing what might be available. It allowed us to not overwhelm the community with questions, because they would bring us together then and we could answer them. And then, you know, Charles gave presentations, different museums, different entities, so that everyone could learn from each other. And the Arts Council has, you know, anywhere from, you know, Newfields down to the two-person shop trying to figure out what this means. And really encourage that sense of community around the arts, performing arts. And I think that was, you know, people offered their expertise with trying to get loans. And really, I don't think people have seen that in other communities in really the same way that Julie and the Arts Council and Ernest really brought to us. And I think that has and will continue to pay dividends over and over and over again. For our future as communities, because you run so quickly when you're open, and this gave everybody a chance to sort of stop and say, oh yeah, Charles, what do you guys are doing this? Oh, well, let's think about that. And which you may not normally have had a chance to do. So I think really she gets a lot a credit, the Arts Council, for really the helping Arts the community.
The Arts Council has done a brilliant job, just a brilliant job. And I do think it'll pay off dividends for a very long time.
I agree. And I think that, like you talked about, it's like the arts community really came together immediately and stepped up and started taking action immediately, because so many of the people that were that are still greatly affected by this pandemic are the artists, the musicians, the dancers, the actors. What's their second job? They're a barista, they wait tables, or they teach. Guess what? They have none of that. It's all gone because of the pandemic. And instead of everybody just freaking out, everybody came together and really started creating solutions. And that was, I think that's one of the most beautiful things that's happened from all of this.
Mm-hmm. And there are, you know, the State Museum and Newfields, we're big organizations. We have a lot of employees. We have a lot of specialized talent. From, you know, COOs to, you know, people who move art, all kinds of stuff. And it's the Arts Council has become a great conduit for, and I'll just use ourselves as an example. You know, we have legal staff on hand. We have all these specialized people. So we created a 17-page sort of how do you get open, how do you close, and how do you get open? And those are documents that, as you said earlier, Mark, nobody ever expected to do it. So you don't have that on your shelf, as opposed to if you have a fire, what do you go do? And so we were able to contribute that to the resource library that the Arts Council now has, which means a two-person shop could actually just page through there and say, what's relevant to us? Hell, we never thought about that. We never did this. All the way up to, we have lots of colleagues, as you alluded to, in the performing arts who aren't going to be open for Lord knows how long. And our experience living it every day now that we have people back is also helpful to be feeding to them, to say, this is what you should expect about visitation. This is what people are telling us. Like wearing masks, 100% of our surveys said almost 100% of our potential visitors coming back wanted us to demand you wear a mask.
Yeah, and I think you both of you are right. Some of the leadership here, your leadership has helped, but we are going to lose, unfortunately, worldwide, we are going to lose some of our colleagues in some large institutions who just were not are going to be unable to weather through this.
I tragically think you're correct. It's hard to predict which ones, but at least in the museum world, I mean, I can pretty well bet, you know, all the museum world in the United States is not particularly well funded, and therefore we don't have large reserves of cash. And there are very few government entities that at this moment have large reserves of cash. And therefore, you know, you're just going to run out of money if you can't get open, if you can't sell tickets, if people don't trust that you're a safe place.
No, and then your foundations and development work is difficult because they are trying to meet a profound need. And so the drain on the foundations makes it harder to ask for a bigger gift. As you go. So, you know, yeah, it's very complicated. Individual donors who are wealthier are afraid enough. They may be earning on their stocks and things that they have, but you're right. I mean, they don't know either. So they're not willing to necessarily make a big gift during a time when it's hard. And so those are all things that we count on. One of the things I wanted to ask you both was when you think about both of you have a collection, both of you have objects, and that becomes part of your teaching and learning. But are you both thinking that it's still important to use those objects with the public to hold on to your education efforts and those? Because I hear some museums, not very many, but a few nationally, that have it's collections preservation at the expense of education and everything else and outreach. What do you both think?
Well, I'll jump in here because we've been sort of nationally been getting attention, if not recognized, for us spending the last 7 years going through all 55,000 objects. And if you think of your house and how much art you might have on your walls, many of us have quite a lot of clutter. It's like you can't imagine what owning and caring for and, you know, conserving 55,000 works of art is a lot of art. And so we've gone through and given it all a letter grade. You know, is it an A? Is it a B? Is it a D? And I think that's going to pay off for us because we do care about objects. But if we continue to collect the amount of stuff we've all been collecting for, many of us, we're 137 years old. That is not sustainable. And I think we have already passed the tipping point of it being sustainable. So you will see us privileging the very best, most eloquent storytelling objects in our collection. But otherwise, we will be continuing to give away objects. Kathy's been a recipient of some of the things that we've done to help furnish her historic homes and buildings around the state, because they're just things we weren't using, and they're much better off at the State Museum telling a different story for the state of Indiana than sitting in my basement. We've given contemporary glass, which we have a great collection of, but 100 pieces sitting in storage forever. Those went to the Glick Glass Center up at Ball State University for students to learn from. So I suspect there'll be a sea change going forward about how are you using that asset, and just the holiness of saying we're just collecting to collect. I think that will wane. And the fact that we're going to have so much pressure on museums to trim their budgets from things like storage and conservation, all that energy and money should be going to the very best objects we have in the collection that can tell the best stories, not just to warehousing stuff, in my humble opinion.
You know, and Mark, when you say that, you know, the visitor is always at the center of any conversation or story you're trying to tell. And so I guess for us, and I think Newfields and other places, Mark and I work together at the Children's Museum, that really, you know, the object and the education and the learning all go together as a part of lifelong learning, a part of the informal learning experience of going to a museum. You know, really where I am putting a lot of our thinking around is the kids not going back to school. And, you know, we develop lifelong learners. Some of these kids, it's their field trip, you know, that was their first time that they'd been to a museum. And that may be where it sparked that love for art or that love for science. Or so really, we are trying to determine how we can help support that audience without asking the schools for one more thing. So are there ways we could be partnering with other people that serve that audience as well? So I think it's not only about, you know, the collection and the objects and the learning, but it's also what are we providing for the community at a time? What do they need from us? How can we be of help? What can we be doing? And, you know, like anything else, it's always a good time to think about, oh, well, let's try it. And people are going to be much more forgiving today than they might have been yesterday. And so our staff has talked about, you know, everybody's got to be open about try it. It could be fun. It could be a disaster. But let's at least all be willing to hear each other. And in a way, you know, we're always looking for the, you know, opportunity in this situation that we're in. And I think that may be something that allows us to say, oh, this is how we've always done it. Oh, we can't do it that way anymore. What might else, you know, we be doing?
Right. It's also there's been some national surveys, and the huge one that LaPlaca Cohen's been doing for Culture Track with 135,000 respondents, and it's pretty over the top for the number of people who answered those surveys. One of the interesting things that caught my eye was, as we've all been pushing more of our content online, because people are just, like, you know, marooned at home online so much more, that some of the heaviest users of that are not traditional museum visitors. It's an audience we seldom get in our front door, and that's a real, in some ways, it's a question mark about why they're finding us and doing that, and will they actually become users? But even if they don't, you know, there clearly is a desire through technology to be able to connect with cultural institutions, including museums.
And it breaks down a barrier that might have been there before about what a museum is and what a museum does and why might I be interested. Yep. So in a way, it's allowing us, as Charles is saying, to introduce people to us without them having to take a big risk, right? So to look at something online isn't a trip, isn't, you know, really allows people to get a better sense of that. And then hopefully we'll break down some of the barriers that have existed in the past about what a museum, quote, is.
And I welcome it.
Absolutely.
Most people of all walks of life and backgrounds do not feel comfortable going to an orchestra, going to a museum. They don't. 76% of Americans do not do any of that.
No.
Which is a large number.
Yeah.
Dr. Charles Venable, he is the director and CEO of the Indianapolis Museum of Art Newfields, along with Kathy Faree, the president and CEO of the Indiana State Museum. We're talking about opening museums during a pandemic and what happens after. We're going to continue our conversation right after this break.
Join us for the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series on Saturday afternoons at 2 o'clock. Host Michael Toulouse brings you his fine commentary as we showcase faculty and visiting artists performing exceptional concerts and recitals from the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center on the University of Indianapolis campus. That's the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artist Series, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on 88.7 WICR.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19. This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
This is Dave Bagdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Rock and roll has evolved over the years from a sound that shaped the youth of a nation.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, girl.
To an era that started a rebellion.
We're the rebel, yeah. She cried, mom, mom, mom.
Or even bringing in a brand new generation. Every week on After Dark, we look through the songs and the stories that shaped rock and roll as we know it today.
After Dark, Sundays at 1 a.m. on 88.7 WICR.
And welcome back. I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're talking about reopening hands-on-based museums during a pandemic. Joining us are Kathy Faree, President and CEO of the Indiana State Museum, and Dr. Charles Venable, Director and CEO of the Indianapolis Museum of Art, Newfields. Right before we took this break, you both were talking about something that I think is really important, and that's the opportunity for different audiences. Both of you in your careers, I have admired that both of you have kind of taken risks, sometimes at your own expense.
Not
in,
us.
In moving, never. Right? In moving an institution to look at new audiences involving that 70-some percent that you were talking about, Charles, that isn't there. It seems like your time is coming, unfortunately, through the pandemic, but it does seem like things are going to have to change and people are going to see something different. How does that make you both feel, having been leaders for a while when it wasn't, you know, the cool thing to do?
Well, I guess I can jump in there a little bit. I've been in the art museum world for 30 something years. I was 27 when I first had my first assistant curatorial job, and now just turned 60 in March, probably brought on the entire pandemic personally. So I've been doing this a long time, a close watcher of museums around the world, and there are going to be some big changes. In many ways, the system that we've built is simply not sustainable for all kinds of reasons. Too many resources going into certain types of things for too few people, frankly. And I think that COVID, the stock market being unstable, all kinds of things, certain communities feeling uncomfortable walking into an institution like the ones that I and Kathy lead. I mean, those are things that have to change because America is changing and has changed already. You know, we've been around 137 years, as I think I said earlier, but in some ways we 10 years ago, we probably were thinking we were in the 1960s or something in terms of the kind of exhibitions we wanted, not using our gardens really much at all. If you knew they were there and enjoyed them, they were like being a private member of the Lilly family in the 1930s or something. Whereas now our largest attendance are actually not art exhibitions. They are, we got 110,000 people this year. If we can do it in November and December, we think we'll get 120,000 people to come to our garden holiday lighting and wonder why. Nobody thinks that's intimidating. It's fun. It's welcoming.
I go every year.
And so those are the kinds of things that we're using. We're treating our what used to be called the grounds as a real botanical garden, and those are the programs that botanical gardens do. But wearing my art hat, that's the welcome mat.
Yeah.
And 20% of those people last year told us they had never stepped foot on the New Folk campus, and yet they're from Indianapolis. I find that it's astounding.
There is Faye Williams, Mark, who I'm sure you all are familiar with, used to talk about disinviters and recognizing those. And really, I think this, as Charles is saying, is giving us an opportunity to look at maybe what are those disinviters and how can we undo those at a time when we have the opportunity to do that. I do think that the arts are going to be as important, if not more important than ever, in bringing communities together. A lot of this isolation that people have been in, the need for communication and socialization, museums do provide a lot of those opportunities for you to be around people without being around people, for you to engage with other people. And I do think that in the future, people who have been introduced to us in one way are going to start looking for us to continue to provide that for them and for the community. And I think that particularly Indianapolis is going to be poised to do that in terms of working collaboratively with all of the resources that we've been given.
Kathy, you know, what you were just saying is interesting for me, because our show's a little bit also about science, and we've both been talking about art. But in this moment, we're also seeing a resurgence of interest in science. We live in a very strange city in terms of that we don't really have a science museum as large as we are, which is very odd. But you and Charles, through what you do with the stuff with conservation, the forensics lab, all that you're bringing that to the public. Kathleen, I know you are the adult science museum really here, as well as a collections base. Our other museums, they may have science, but they're for very young kids. And so we really miss that middle audience, you know, that audience that most cities gather in there. So you guys have real opportunities through what you do with science. You want to talk a little bit about those initiatives?
Yeah, I think it's really important, and something that I think has developed over time. People talk about multidisciplinary, and I always talk about interdisciplinary. And really offering people opportunities, multiple entry points to experiences. So it doesn't need to be an science experience or a history experience or an art experience. And Charles has done a lot of this as well, as really providing multiple entry points. And my family couldn't be more diverse in our learning styles and our interests. And so every once in a while, I'm like, even my dad doesn't care about that. But really, you have to really look at that. And that, I think, is allowing all of us in institutions to not be cornered into, Charles isn't only an art museum, right? Because he's now doing science, botanical gardens, and all of those things. And we have a wide breadth of opportunity with our collection that does have a lot of those, being based in natural history to start with. So you will see us continue to do a lot more interdisciplinary experiences for all the reasons that you've just said, because we know we don't always can prove it, which I really would like to prove it. But sometimes kids don't think they're interested in science until they go to a museum and they do, quote, science, because they don't know it's science, right? It's this cool thing with this microscope. And I thought that was fascinating. And oh my God, like, you study that. I really think that we are going to be important to helping continue that introduction to how does science relate in the rest of my world? How does art relate? What does that look like? The environmental concept. We have two historic sites that are based on Gene Stratton Porter. The environment can't be more important today than yesterday. And all of the institutions have a chance to touch on those so that you can introduce people to them at a time where they can hear you rather than this is your science class and you're going to do science and love it. We're going to give you a chance to sort of pick and choose around that.
Great, Charlie.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you think about it, what Kathy's saying is how life really is. It's all jumbled up together. You may become a nuclear physicist, but it doesn't mean you never saw a painting. And many of our museums, I think we've spent the last 50 years, 60 years becoming so professionalized, so specific, so sort of perfect in art history, frankly, is a really tiny discipline. And yet art is everywhere and people are very creative. Same thing with science. And the fact that we have one of the, I think there are 8 analytical science labs and art museums in the United States that can study pigments and canvas and all this stuff, a major conservation program, as well as a whole raft of horticulturalists, all who've studied science and botany, and all these art historians, frankly, jumbling it all up and mixing it is creating better products for us. And I think the staff is enjoying it much more. When I arrived in 2012, it was quite stark how isolated, let's just say, the natural science in terms of our gardens and park staff were from the main art history staff. Whereas now they all just feed off of each other, helping us on cross-departmental teams create, I think, much more interesting exhibitions that are much more relevant to a regular person's life.
Yeah, I agree with both of you on that. I think in the late 80s, we did a survey of scientists living in Chicago area. And what was interesting was from the very top scientists who make it in their field to get a Nobel Prize all the way down, we surveyed them and almost bar none, all of them had spent time hanging out in museums, not just science museums.
Yeah.
And so as I look at some famous artists, as I look at people in communities, it is that hanging out. And we kind of moved away from it. I'm not saying we got too slick, but in some ways maybe we did with our exhibitry and forget about that maybe people just need to hang out with cool stuff. And I think both of you are doing that. I mean, I think you're less worried about the measurables of, do we teach this like a school, but do we open experiences for people to be educated in an informal, non-formal way?
We also provide opportunity for people to meet, and I am very contextually oriented. I'm a type one learner, and I ask why all the time, and it makes everybody crazy. But it does give you a chance. You can meet a scientist at the State Museum. You can meet a scientist at Newfield and not know that's what they are and ask a lot of questions where you might not have any other way to have had interaction with a scientist if you don't happen to have any in your family or you. So another time we really do introduce people to topics and to real people practicing those things that they may or may not be interested in.
That's great. Jill, we've been talking a little bit about the challenges of, with how we can retain what's best about us during this time. And I think what's best about museums, honestly, both of you have embodied in your institutions. As we think about how we go from here, I would assume some of your thought is to try to retain some of the things we had to pivot to do. Would that be true? I mean, are you going to try to retain some of the online kinds of experiences, that kind of thing?
Oh, I think we will. I mean, we pivoted as quickly as we could to, we've always had some online things, but Newfields at Home, all of a sudden, almost every museum in the world probably had something similar. And we started posting a lot more content that we had canned, but we also just decided, we couldn't edit every little footage of video. I mean, so our curators literally are at home with their phones or, doing pretty wonderful things. And what we found, at least what I'm told by our social media folks, is that the things that are more casual and sort of spur of the moment much higher watch rate, just all as opposed to the perfect, all edited, all, you know, perfect sound, everything. People are sort of turned off by it right now because they're all sitting at home kind of trying to do it themselves. And it's hard to be perfect. And we're sort of addicted to it.
You know, I think the other thing that we've really found that has built the confidence in the staff is that they can pivot, right? Yeah. I mean, this, like, yeah, no choice here. But I do think, again, that as an industry, we now see we can pivot. What does that mean? And so I think you'll see us being much better at responding and reacting than maybe we have in the past. Someone used to say to me, glaciers pass museums by and their ability to sometimes get an exhibit developed and done and on the floor, not unlike what Charles is saying, you know, everything had to be perfect, right, done. I think really that we have learned as an industry and cultural institutions and the performing arts are, you know, performing in, you know, yards and street. Everybody is really learning that we have a lot more opportunity than we even knew we had. And we have a lot more creativity and ability to be flexible than we ever imagined that we could.
It's absolutely true.
And a lot of that is because this younger generation is so used to that. They're so tech savvy. You know, when everything shut down, you had to go find like a third grader to get you back online to show you what to do. So in a way, it's perfect timing because you want to bring in this younger crowd. You want them to come to museums to experience what's there. But they're, like you were saying, Kathy, they don't need it to be perfect. They're much more comfortable with seeing things kind of loose and here, there, and everywhere. And so it is giving, you know, all museums an opportunity to rethink how they're going to move forward and what the comfort level of people is going to be as people come back out again. What do they want from a museum too? Because their needs are going to have changed as well. As you talked about, everybody kind of wants to get out and do something, but is it safe? And I think that's another area that, you know, we talked about earlier in this conversation, the surveys that you did and that the Arts Council did to ask the public and to ask the organizations, what is it going to take to make it safe and secure for people? And what is it that they're going to see? So you have that data there as well that will help you move forward when you're reestablishing collections and going back to get funding in the future.
I think for both of you too, that what I see happening with the audience is what we think of as being good theater. And that's, good theater can operate with very few props and without a big giant set. You can just set it up. And I think that's what you guys are finding out online. We may not have to, that's another cost savings in the future. We might not have to forever create something that feels real in a gallery exhibit. We may be able to set the stage and allow people's imaginations and minds to create that. And that's what I meant about the slickness. And I think both of you are onto something with that, not only during this, but already were. You were already, you know, making some changes that I think are setting you in the right course for the future.
I do think it's also taught us to be, to recognize, you know, we're a little slow to the data. You know, we're nonprofit, we're informal learning. You can't measure that, can't be measured. And then we went to the, everything was measured by numbers and people. But what I do think is that we are recognizing how to use the data and how to respond and react to rather than be immobilized by. And I think that is something that is another opportunity that this has given us, is to just see how to use it and how to use it properly and how not to overreact or underreact. And people are right now a little more forgiving about that as we move forward. So it gives us an opportunity to be smarter about using the data to our benefit.
And I would add smarter and also more flexible. You know, this, as horrible as all this is, a slight silver lining is we don't have any choice but to be a lot more flexible. And we, as you know, every day we have more people coming in the door and we're learning literally as we go. I mean, we created a whole new entrance to the garden because we didn't want you to come to our welcome center all of a sudden because that was indoors until the numbers got down to a certain level, and then we can welcome you back. But we literally have a meeting every day checking up on how's it going, what's happening in real time, what are people saying, and trying to make adjustments to make sure that people are safe, but also that they know they're safe as much as humanly possible.
Yeah.
And we
knew, because as go ahead, Kathy.
We knew, you know, sort of right away, we have the, at our sites that we had opportunities that maybe we hadn't been able to take. So that was one of the early on challenges, knowing that people were going to be skittish about going indoors. So what could we offer externally at those sites and still be able to charge for it, still to be a valued experience the same way, you know, that you had been there before it. So, you know, if you visit Gene Stratton Porter in Rome City right now, you can get a lot of Gene's story by touring her garden in the same way you might if you're really not interested in going in the house. So pulling out those things and allowing people to have similar experiences, not the same, but how do you translate the context in which you give out that same information in a way that right now people can hear it?
Right.
And has that been invigorating then for your staff, or has it been just perplexing? I mean, they're kind of, in a way, they get to like be extra creative now, looking at angles that they maybe had never thought of before.
Sure. On a good day, they would tell you that it's fantastic and fabulous. Charles is laughing too. Easy for
they're
us.
They're all to exhausted.
Exhausted, yeah.
Everybody's sure. Exhausted.
You know, no more new ideas. Yeah. We're just trying to be sure the hand sanitizer is where it's supposed to be. But I do think that it has given confidence to the staff. You know, it's one thing for Charles or I to say, oh, we should, you know, blah, blah, blah. And them to be like, oh, here she goes again. Instead of, hey, we could try it, and if it doesn't work, we can just tell her it didn't work, and nothing ventured, nothing lost. And, you know, it's just like any other learning opportunity. If you fail, you know, right now we're in a position where we can and will fail, and the staff is getting more used to that, that, you know, some things just aren't going to work. But we're going to have to try a lot of different things because we're being given lots of different circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
And a great example.
Go ahead, Charles.
I was just going to say a quick example for us is we opened our gardens and our park first, but we knew we were hopefully going to get the building open not too many weeks later. And we had a conundrum because we are the only other stop for a big Edward Hopper show that opened in Richmond, Virginia. And we're a partner on it and has that one of our great masterpieces by that American painter in it. And so we worked to keep the show on the books and redid all the loans and stuff behind the scenes. But then, of course, it was all planned pre-COVID. So there's all these tactile things in the shows.
I know.
We had ordered all of these extraordinary reproductions of 1930s phones, for example, that you would pick up and listen to the sound pieces. And then all of a sudden, you know, my head of exhibition said, nobody's going to want to pick up any of this stuff. And so it was really, and I totally agreed, but it was really my staff who took the lead and said, we're going to rejigger this and rejigger this, and there's going to be no iPad touching. And you know, now that show's open, it'll be with us through October. And, you know, it's just seamless. And that was a staff saying, we've got to go do it, and me agreeing, but they're the ones who called all their colleagues all over the country and said, how are you doing this? How are you doing that? And everybody was just as nice to share as could be, because there were some parts of the country that reopened earlier and they knew what their visitors would and wouldn't do.
It's great.
I do think that the museum community, because we don't sit really in each other's markets, you know, I always say we're the best stealers ever of great ideas. I think this has only been amplified because as, you know, yes, in Indianapolis we have, but AAM has been bringing together CEOs so we can ask questions not in front of anyone that everybody is sort of curious about or wondering about. And I know our staff has spent a lot of time on the phone with their colleagues across the country saying, what are you doing? What are you doing? And nobody's like, no, you can't do that. That's mine. It's more like, I'll send it to you. Maybe you'll be able to use it. And we've really, the industry's always been that way to a point. And I think this has really given an opportunity for people to see where it does have a big benefit to it. It's another, it's like, oh, why did she wants me to call one more person? But this time it's more like, oh yeah, maybe if I call, I heard somebody say something on a call that seemed similar. And now they have the minute to do it, right? You know, and I think to me, I keep looking for the opportunity that we're being presented here. And in that, I think, as we've indicated, is that we're getting a chance to be smarter and have more flexibility than we might have had we not had this situation.
Right. The pandemic has also been somewhat of a leveler, I would say, because there's not a museum in the country that doesn't have financial problems right now. And even if you're, you know, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the biggest museum in the world, it's still closed. They may not even open till September, who knows? And all of a sudden it's like, you know, they return phone call. Not that they wouldn't have before, but it's like they need help from places that have opened to help them. Even if you're not really doing a lot of business together, the network has gotten much tighter. And because of technology like the Zoom call we're on, it means the art museum directors of my budget side can talk every single week, which normally we would all get together one time a year at basically a convention. And so it's really just sped up communication in a dramatic way.
Good way. And we're going to continue our communication with Dr. Charles Venable with the Newfields and Kathy Faree with the Indiana State Museum. We want to remind you, though, that this program is made possible by the generosity of an anonymous donor who supports the Da Vinci Pursuit's mission of creating a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can come together for unique activities and conversations. And we'll continue ours in just a moment.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor, tune out all that noise, and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield-Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
We are strong, we are resilient, and we will get through this together. But these are stressful times, and it's important to also practice good self-care. It's normal to feel overwhelmed, anxious, or afraid, but there is hope. Reach out to someone, connect with your friends, stay in touch with your community, and know that you are not alone. Learn more at wearebroadcasters.com/hope, furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR, The Diamond.
Welcome back. We've been talking to Dr. Charles Venable with Newfields and Kathy Faree with the Indiana State Museum. And, you know, we kind of started at the beginning talking about the idea of hands-on. And you just were alluding to that a little bit, how things have had to be reconfigured in a time when we all moved, you know, that was the industry moved to hands-on. Hands-on was everything. And now it's like, oh my gosh, we can't do hands-on. So, Charles, you have an exhibit on Hopper. How have you been able to handle that in a non-hands-on way?
Well, and it was designed to have a lot of hands-on, touchable things. And so we've retrofitted, you know, no longer do you get a handheld 1930s phone to pick up and hear things about Hopper and what it was like. It's all about the theme of hotels and isolation and things like that. Turned out to be really timely, it seems like, that way. So those are now, you know, you walk up, you hit a little invisible beam, and you hear the sound in a controlled way. So you still get the same information. The maybe a even more interesting example is the show sort of set, if you was designed with a room based on a Hopper painting that you could walk into and sort of experience in your mind and your body what being in a Hopper painted hotel room would be like. And that's the way that played out in Richmond. And the show was cut short there because they had to close the Richmond Museum of Fine Art, the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts. We eventually reworked it, got it here, but then we retrofitted the room because we don't want to allow, you know, 6-8 people in a fairly small space because you can't social distance. So now you can look into the room, which is fantastic too, but you're not going to be able to experience it in quite the same way. We've also had to close like our early childhood learning activity centers. We've had all those kind of spaces across our galleries. We've closed all of those because it's simply impossible to do the amount of sanitization you would need with small kids, you know, every 15 minutes, every 30 minutes of the day. And we've also removed quite a lot of iPad things delivered on iPads because our public doesn't want to touch them. And so we don't want to put them out there. We will put them back when the coast is clear later.
Well, and that was one of the reasons you had to shut the outdoor, the 100 acres too, because everything out there, people love to crawl all over that art.
That's true. And it's, you know, that's a 100 acres, a lot of acreage. And there's no way I can sanitize every one of those yellow yet behind benches, you know, all the swing sets. And also early on, we were not seeing the public social distancing. That has gotten much, much better as things gotten horribly much, much worse, and people sort of got the message that this was not playtime.
Yeah, and again, in Marion County, leadership has helped with that. Kathy, I know you have so many wonderful things that we can touch and do. How are you handling the non-touch?
We are in a multitude of ways. I do think it's interesting, and Charles, I'm sure you all have talked about this as well. We also have to keep in mind, you've alluded to it, but what's our social responsibility? You know, what are we inviting people to do? What are we allowing people to do? Because they're counting on us to have made good decisions.
Right.
About that. So we have, you know, reconfigured the museum. You go one way through the building so you don't pass people. We have hand sanitizer about every 3 feet. You know, we've lit up the bathrooms so that it encourages you to go, you know, wash your hands. We have two staff members who are literally sort of the Golden Gate Bridge theory. They, you know, start at the top, they work their way down, they start back up again. You know, they're, I'm sure, and I know Charles has the same, you know, the bathrooms get cleaned and it's again, they get cleaned and they clean and they start over again and they're cleaning again. And we know that the visitors are counting on us to do that. So, you know, those are types of things that normally you wouldn't want people to see you do, right? Again, back behind the scenes. Now it's something that people need to see us doing, right? In order to feel like we are in fact following through. And they have the expectation that we will. The great news is that museums people are very fastidious. So cleaning things all the time makes many of them super happy. So I do think that there's, you know, again, the benefit to that is you feel like, oh, if I touch that, you know, there's hand sanitizer right here, I see the bathrooms, right. I can go there. So anytime we have been very cognizant of the fact that if there is something that you would like to touch, you're like turned around and you run into the hand sanitizer. But we've had to be really, you know, very pick and choose about that. As Charles said, you know, we've had some really awesome immersive art pieces that, can't go in. So we've had the artists come in and work with us to figure out how to be sure we can still get the message across. And it was a fort, and it was one of my favorite things, and they said I needed to get over it. But he was able to really look at how could he develop that in a way, as Charles was saying, you know, either look in the room or different ways we could tell the story to encourage similar actions without it needing to be inside touching things. And I think we are struggling with that. Museums, I think, are struggling with that because we do and have learned over the years that, that engagement, that hands-on sensory experience really does a lot for people's ability to learn and be responsive. So how do we, again, not take away the experience that we know is effective, but make really sure that we're being smart and responsible about what we invite our guests to do.
Yeah, we've pretty much, with the Venture Pursuit, shut down doing public art that is interactive outside because we don't have a way with the social responsibility you all were talking about of being sure that we keep people safe. Mm-hmm. And so it's difficult to create things that are very interactive, and touch is so important because it's touch the site, as you all know, to touch the site and then the intellectual part that all come together, they light up different parts of our brain. So, but I think that the positive for both of you that you're talking about is that it's enabling staff to learn how interactivity can be broader. Because I think we had gotten in some places to where we quickly would just put something out. All they have to do is touch it. We're going to another level and saying, well, what does it mean to have an experience with something that's deep and meaningful rather than it's just there, you can enjoy it?
Yeah, we've only got about a minute left, but I'm guessing that all that's going to be in your mind as you plan ahead for what exhibits you'll be showing next too. That's another challenge, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's a huge challenge to figure out. What you can do next year is a huge challenge. And we're used to planning like 3 years in advance.
I know.
Absolutely. And I mean, and it's a opportunity, but always being cognizant of looking at the data, asking questions, asking other people, planning, being ready to unplan, that I think that we're just going to have to get used to for a while. And will, I think, probably make us a stronger industry in the end.
I agree with that.
So I love to think of 1918 happened, but the Roaring Twenties came back afterward.
I love thinking of that. That's a great way to end this segment. Thank you so much.
It is, because we don't want you to go away, and our listeners don't either. And we really want to thank both of you, Kathy Faree, President and CEO of the Indiana State Museum, and Dr. Charles Venable, the Melvin and Bren Simon Director and CEO of Newfields.
And you'll find pictures of projects and our guests on our website, thedaVinciPursuit.com, where we create museums without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations.
And until our next conversation, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to stay curious.
Stay curious.
Thank you for listening to She Says Art and He Says Science. You can listen to the full show podcast on WICRonline.org, as well as on the DaVinciPursuit.com. Or you could join Jill Dittmeyer and Mark Kiesling every Saturday live on a different kind of public radio, 88.7 WICR.